Okay. Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you all for coming on this nice, hot summer day here in New Hampshire. It's great to see everybody again, finally, since we haven't gotten together in quite a while. So, with that, I wanted to start, and I just want to thank Joe and the members of the board for joining us here today. Some quick notes as we begin the meeting. This meeting's being recorded. Before speaking, please state your name so that the transcription service can actually document today's meeting. Today's meeting is an official meeting of the board. It's open to the public and will be run in a manner compliant with RSA 91-A. Meeting materials for the board and the public can be found by visiting the New Hampshire Works webpage or www.nhworks.org. Again, today's meeting is being recorded. As this is the first in-person board meeting since February of 2020, we have a number of items to work through. You will find these items on the agenda with their enclosed supportive documents. The agenda and these documents have been provided to the board electronically last week, and printed copies are available today, and all materials will be made available to the public. With that, Joe, could you call the roll?
Yes, sir. Mike Alberts.
Here.
Beth Doran. Eric Batchelor. Mark Bodwin.
There.
Christine Brennan. Anya Brzezinski. Will Arvello. David Chaffee.
Here.
Kelly Clark. George Kapatis.
Here.
Dwight Davis. Julie Demers. The board has Anthony Ginta as Mayor of Franklin. He has resigned from the board, and I will mark him as also absent for the record. William Hatch. John Hennessy. Jay Kahn. Michael Kane. Tamer Cohill.
Here.
Charlene Lovett.
Here.
Robert Martell. Jonathan Melanson.
Here.
Steve Norton. Eric Prue. James Prue. Tim Sink. Mike Summers.
Here.
Gary Thomas. Michael Turmel. Brandon Wagner. With the roll call, we are short quorum by two, Mr. Chairman. We cannot vote on things, but we can go through informational items and have discussions as long as there are no binding votes, sir.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Thanks, Joe. The meeting minutes from February 3rd are found in the packet, and although we're not able to take a motion to approve the minutes, if anybody has any issues with the minutes, errors, corrections, or omissions, we can listen and hear that. No, nothing.
I sent mine to Joe Lovett.
Okay. Okay. Welcome to the first in-person board meeting since February 2020. We appreciate you being here with us today. Unfortunately, our chairman, Mr. Michael Kane, could not be with us as he has a family obligation. He has asked me to step in for him today. Is there any public comment from anybody? Well, this could be a quiet meeting. informational items. We're going to start the agenda today with some informational items. We're going to move, we're going to take 2A, we're going to move 2G up to 2A, and we're going to start with a WIOA Youth presentation.
And the folks from my turn, Jack, if you would like to join at the table there. The table's there. Yep, right.
Yep. Hi, everybody. My name is Allison Joseph. I'm the executive director of MyTurn. We're one of the youth contractors in the state that we brought with us on KM. We've a fantastic Dante came to my parents a long time ago when I was still the career specialist in Central High School, participated in the in-school youth program, and then for a variety of reasons, which you'll hear about in a few minutes, she fell off track a little bit and pursuing her career goal, and was fortunate enough to be able to re-enroll in our in-school youth program. And has been exceptional with us, and she's just getting ready to exit as a follow-up portion of our program.
Is it okay if Tucker introduces himself?
Yeah, sure.
Sure. Hi, I'd like you all to meet Tucker Sargent. Tucker is an LNA working at Havenwood Heritage Heights. He comes straight from work, taking a break. And my name is Janet Arnett. I'm the executive director of New Hampshire Kids. And his specialist is with us today as well, Stacey Den. Stacey saw Tucker through many challenges as he came into the program, but he's been a real star for us. He's gone through his training and is really dedicated to working in the healthcare field. So things keep rolling.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, thank you for coming directly from work, too. So why don't we start with either one, whoever wants to start first. Just flip a coin, whatever you'd like to do.
So, again, for the record, I'm Tucker Sargent. I didn't really come with anything prepared, per se. I'm not a great public speaker, but I figured if there's any questions you have, I can field those. If not, I can just kind of give you a basic overview of what kind of to JAG and how they help me through a lot of stuff. So.
I'd like to hear just, you know, a little bit about yourself, you know, where you came from, what you were doing, what attracted you to this field, things like that, or, and if anybody else has anything else they'd like to add.
Yeah. I think it was 2019, was when I first kind of discovered JAG. I was in a bit of a pickle, in a rush to find housing. It was a weird situation, and also a job, and I found JAG. I got together with Stacy, and she helped me through that, helped me find an apartment, and helped me get a job at the TCA first at Havenwood, which is practical care attendant. Sorry for the acronym. As I was also working to get my LNA license, which Stacey also went to LNA Health Careers, which is the program I got my license through. I graduated there actually the week that everything shut down for COVID. Thank God I got through just barely in time, and was able to just move into a position as an LNA at Havenwood. I don't know if any of you know a lot about how Havenwood has handled the COVID kind of crisis, but honestly, we have a lot of great staff there. As far as I'm aware, not a single one of the residents in the community itself always know I want to go into nursing, but I think I think it was around 17 when I spent a fairly short period of time at Boston Children's Hospital, and just the care from like the nursing staff there, it meant a lot to me. Awake is something that it was like, man, like, I would love to help people, but like, people help me here. And so I got into nursing. My goal is eventually to be a pediatric nurse. I'm hoping to get my LPN. That's kind of my next step along the line. See if I can find a job in pediatrics as well, just to get that experience. So that's hopefully where I'm headed. I guess again, it's good to be here and to kind of represent what JAG is here for. So thank you.
Thank you very much. That's a great presentation. And people, questions or anything?
Yeah. Congratulations, by the way. A great success story. And you've got a great career. Challenging to be in the healthcare business for sure, particularly during the COVID situation. So you want to probably quit real quick and be like, what's going on? What have been some of the biggest challenges for you, and how have you overcome those to continue to be successful?
Yeah, thank you for asking. I think a lot of it is just the mental piece. The job, it can be physically taxing at times, but I like to think I'm in good enough shape to be able to handle it. But a lot of it is just the mental. It can be overwhelming at times. I work on the dementia unit at Havenwood. So it can be overwhelming at times. A lot of the residents have a hard time communicating or can't really communicate. We don't necessarily know what they want or what they're specific situations that directly tell you. There's times when you have to deal with residents who, for one reason or another, may have just a bad day. You have to deal with sundowning. There's a lot of different just pieces that you have to be able to process quickly, but also rationally. And it helps me a lot to take a step back, to have some alone time. I very much enjoy listening to music, actually. That helps me de-stress, especially sometimes running or working out can help me just kind of take that mental energy and put it into like a physical manifestation. And sometimes exhausting the body physically can help the mind slow down as well, I have found. I also have a good support network. Stacey's always been there for me, and I have some other good friends that if I'm going to YouTube, I can go to them and I can talk about things. That's been so fun.
That's great. Thanks. Congratulations, and we're giving a lot back and taking a little bit for yourself. So I'm sure the people all appreciate that.
Dave.
During the process of your training, did you have ample opportunity to shadow people in the industry that you wanted to go in? I do volunteer work at the VA hospital in White River, and I see a lot of that, and a lot of good questions being asked, and I'm wondering if you had that opportunity.
I did, yes. So my clinicals that I did through LNA Health Careers were in Franklin. They were at, I believe it was St. Francis Retirement Home. And then when I came to Havenwood as well, they have kind of a transition period where they have a new LNA shadow, a LNA that's been there for a while, and knows a lot more about, you know, the floor, the residents, and the facility itself. So I was able to do that. I was able to shadow a couple different people. I did some work on most of the different units before I kind of settled into the dimension unit. So yes, I was able to do that, and actually, I am now have also had the opportunity to help other new LNAs. They've been able to shadow me and kind of follow me around, and I've been able to show them what to do. So yes.
Well, congratulations on your perseverance. It's nice to see more men, males getting into nursing. I'm beginning to see it over at the VA now. And I have a brother who started out at the bottom just like you, and he's retiring now after some 40 years as the director of the Rutland Area Visiting Nurse Service. But he started down where you were, so hang in there, because you sound like you've got what it takes with the good training you've had.
Any other questions, anybody? Yes, Mayor.
Just a comment and a question, Tucker. Thank you for spending your simple question and then one comment is how did you find out about the program?
So actually it's hard to remember specifically. I think it was kind of a joint thing of Stacy used to have an office actually in the basement level of Chamberlain itself. And correct me if I'm wrong, Stacy. But I believe it was kind of a mutual thing of I was already looking at Chamberlain as a possibility of employment. Well, at the same time, I believe also I did some research as well online, and was able to find Stacy. So it's kind of the beautiful thing of I did the research there. I was also kind of looking at you with the monster, so it just happened to work out that I was able to.
That's how you found out about
the Yes, it was the research online at first that I found out about JAG.
So you went to check that?
Yes. So, well, I'll back up a step. I was homeschooled, so I did not get the chance to kind of participate in the program in high school. So I was homeschooled through high school. So it was a thing of I was in a place where I could need some help with my housing. And schooling and career, so I did some research and I found JAG. I think it's really like my choice too when I met him, so I changed it to myself.
Relationships are key, correct?
Exactly.
So, well, right. I appreciate all the initiatives you've taken, and I appreciate the support that you've given me, and good luck in your future endeavors.
Any other questions from anybody? That was a great presentation, and best of luck to you in your endeavors. I'm sure you're going to be very successful. Dantaya, is that a...
Dantaya.
Yeah. Dantaya, yes.
So I'm going to read mine because I'm not a good...
That's fine. However, whatever you're most comfortable with.
Okay. So, hello, my name is Dantaya Brewer, and I'm in the follow-up phase of the MyTurn program in Manchester. I first joined MyTurn back in high school, where I participated in the in-school youth program at Central High. After high school, MyTurn helped me enroll at Manchester Community College, where I finished my first year of college before giving birth to my daughter. After I had my daughter, I had to put my studies on hold to work full-time to support us. I worked at Walmart for a few years before my mother passed away, and I became the legal guardian of my younger sister. At 20 years old, I found myself homeless with a 1-year-old and an 8-year-old in my care and my support system. After coaching for a few months, I was fortunate enough to get into business transition. From there, I completed a work experience through NHEP and was offered a full-time position that I accepted. After working at my work experience site for nearly 3 years, I was still earning less than $12 per hour. I resigned from that position in 2018 and enrolled in my MyTurn out-of-school youth program to pursue a career in healthcare, my lifelong goal. Alicia helped me explore different trainings and settled on medical administrative assistant. While I was in the training program, my turn helped me get caught up on my past due bills, pay for car insurance, and made sure I had everything I needed to set up a good home for my daughter and sister. They purchased a bed, school supplies, and clothing for my sister so I can focus on sleeping and training instead of taking up extra shifts at the grocery store where I was working part-time. I worked very hard to complete my training program in just under 3 months. Alicia helped me to update my resume and apply for a position at Yale Hospital. When I received an invitation to the interview, Alicia and Allie helped me prepare by asking me lots of questions until I felt confident in my response. Shortly after I interviewed, I was offered a per diem position in patient services in the lead-up department of the hospital. I have now been with Elliot for a year and a half and have my own apartment. I have re-enrolled in Manchester Community College where I will begin to pursue an associate's degree in nursing this fall. When I walk into Elliot, I know that I am making a difference in people's lives and I know that I am on the path I was meant to be on. I am grateful for everything that my turn has done for me and my family, and I am confident that the skills I have developed in the program will help me accomplish all of my future goals.
That's super. Thank you. Oh, no. Please. Please. That was a great job. And you've done great work there. You and I went to the same high school, not the same year, though.
Right.
Questions from any of the board members?
Could you just give us a little bit of detail of what you do on a daily basis at work?
So I mainly check people in, check people out. I do scheduling of future appointments.
Yep.
And then make calls for people that are on wait list, and like new patient appointments, put all that information into the system to get them to come to rehab.
That's great. You feel really confident in doing that, and
yes,
gives you some rewards back.
Yes, I love it.
Great.
Thank you.
Yes, Mayor.
Not so much a question, but I want to hear. You're back here, yeah, but I was already getting to you did, because you deserve a lot of admiration because of the very early age in your life, you've had to deal with some very difficult things, and I commend you for persevering and being a great role model for your sister, your daughter, I think it's your daughter, yeah, right? And I hope when you have more time, maybe right now, raising children is a very busy time of our life. But when you have more time, I hope you become a role model for other young women, because nothing motivates people more than hearing about real life experiences and that it can be done. You have a wonderful story to share.
Thank you.
So thank you for all that you have done, and good luck with all your future.
Thanks, Mayor. Others? Anything else? Well, thank you both very much for coming here and telling your story. And again, they're very successful stories, and we wish you both the best of luck in your future endeavors. We know you're going to do great out there. And keep up the good work. Thank you.
And real fast, before we move forward, just James, just want to call you for the role. And can I get the pronunciation on your last name, sir?
Mm-hmm.
Very good. James.
I do go by Jim.
Okay, Jim. Perfect. So recognizing that Jim has joined us, Mr. Chairman, we are still one short for quorum, although we were told that somebody is on their way.
Correct. Okay, well, we're going to move on now. For the financial update, Laura LaCane, to answer any questions. Yeah, why don't you move over?
And the documents can be found for board members and members of the public, page 91 of the board packet. Thank you. It might have not translated over on the, that must have been an error on the printing, which I apologize for. Laura, do you think you could talk through some of that for us?
Questions?
So, I don't know if I understand this correctly. But when the RFPs go out and the contracts are awarded, it's, you know, there might be even other areas of the state that haven't been met because they didn't receive or they didn't submit an RFP or they weren't awarded the contract. So my question is, how are the discretionary funds allocated to further at least the awareness of these programs for us?
Did you want to speak to that, Joe?
Yes. So, and for the record, Joe Dorian, and so we are actually, for the first time, this office is investing in some marketing. So we are working with our partners at BEA and the Division of Travel and Tourism. If you've seen their ads, they're pretty good. They have, you know, good web presence and understanding in an existing state contract. So we're actually looking to piggyback off of their existing contract for marketing materials to tell more of those success stories like Dantea and Tucker, and also to make more awareness of the programs that exist. And Laura, correct me if I'm wrong, we're looking at, what, $100,000 over the biennium, so breaking it down to $50,000 each year, but we have the option to increase that. We just have to commit to a number for the contract for the marketing budget, but we can also go underneath as well. So we have some flexibility. We had to put a placeholder in, so we worked with our partners at Travel and Tourism to talk about some ideas and what they think might be a good investment to start. Did that help?
Yes.
Okay.
Any other questions? Hearing none. Okay. Hey, Tim. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Thank you for coming. Okay. Thank you.
And again, for the record, we now have a quorum with Tim Sink joining us. So we are now able to vote on things that the board wishes to act upon.
And before we go to the next informational item, what I'd like to do is go back to the approval of the February 3rd, 2021 minutes, which we were not able to approve earlier because we didn't have a quorum. Or any errors, corrections, or omissions? If not, I'll entertain a motion to approve those minutes.
Moved
by Mike Summers, second.
Second.
Second by Mike Alberts.
If we could add the modification that I sent, Joe, on page 15, that the last line of the first full paragraph
one correction, yeah. Okay, motion made. Second, any other corrections, omissions? Hearing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
I'm gonna abstain since I was at GNC for that meeting.
Okay. Do you want to move on now to...
Yes, sir.
Are you doing these, or do you want me to do them?
Yeah.
But okay, Jim, can you come up to do the rapid response piece?
I am the Workforce Development Administrator, but also Rapid Response Coordinator for the State of New Hampshire. This report finds us going from last year, an additional 14 over from where we were last year, the rapid responses. So this time last, at the end of last year, we had 10 total. Right now, we're looking at 24. Nothing seems kind of out of the ordinary. As we talk about a substantial layoff of the 24 that we have, we're talking about any time that you have 25 or over, just so that we make that clear. The downside of that, 1,245 workers were affected across the state. Since the last time we met, we had 6 rapid response, of which 280 were impacted. Being on the ground and being able to talk to some of these businesses, it's been great because a lot of these businesses, as they lay people off, people are finding work really quickly. So it's, you always go into a rapid response with a little bit of dread, but it always does make you feel a lot better when the partners all come together and you start to hear about people getting jobs and then making arrangements with their current employers to stay on staff until they actually, the layoff comes before they go to their next job. And that's really what we want to be able to do. We did do some pretty neat stuff on June 1st of this month. We are starting in-person rapid responses again, where we will bring teams into the field for any closure or layoff of 25 or over. We will continue to offer Zoom meetings for businesses that do not feel comfortable allowing us into their space. The more important thing is to make sure that the information is getting to the employees so that they understand the services that are available and the employment opportunities that are available. In addition to our Zoom capability, we briefly mentioned it at the last meeting about putting together a potential video that outlines the whole thing. Our big concern at that point was, what are we doing with businesses that lay off under 25? How are we working with people, our citizens, our neighbors, when they lose their jobs and getting them information? This video now does that. All of our agency partners joined in. We have little snippets. You can watch the whole entire video that covers the entire rapid response program and services. And then you can also drill down to each individual agency and watch them on their own. One of the things I love about this that I really think makes New Hampshire really unique is we have points of contact for each one of those agencies. Real people who live in the state with real phone numbers that work that you can call and get immediate assistance. So having the video up, and in addition to doing that, working with the same kind of partners that are helping us do some of the ads, working internally with the BEA staff to create and update our rapid response webpage that also lists all the different resources. That is up and running. We made sure that there are hyperlinks in the report. I would encourage you to use this with your constituents. Anybody you know, anybody that gets laid off from work, even if they're looking for a job, have them look at this. We want them back in the workforce. The other thing that was just about finished, we had a draft of the standard operating procedure. This is really an internal guide used for facilitation purposes only that really guides the facilitator through what is expected to be used what's expected to be presented during a rapid response presentation. This guide has been completed. Now that some of the restrictions have been lifted off of COVID, it needs to be updated again. So we're updating that again as we speak. But this guide will be used for new staff members as they come on board at any agency to train them on the actual rapid response procedure and process to ensure continuity, whether you're from Claremont or whether you're from North Conway or the Seacoast. Everybody will receive the same amount of information and access to the services that we offer. And that's my report, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, Jim. Questions from board members? Michael.
So you have 14 more this year. How have you been able to rally a staff to go out? Because I know you go right in and support. So you're pooling from other parts of the departments within the state to get folks to go with you?
Yeah, we ended up doing that through utilizing Zoom at this point. We worked with the Business and Economic Affairs retention team. They would actually facilitate those in their local areas, and there are already pre-designated individuals that we would send out a rapid response notice. So like if a business reports to me, I go in and make sure that it is a legitimate business and I have a point of contact. Once I have a point of contact, I talk about what are some things that we can do early to do for layoff aversion at my level and at Joe's level. After we get that done, then we start to disseminate that to the field. So all the agencies already have key points of contact literally in each of our NH Works offices that are ready to respond at a moment's notice. We can literally put on a rapid response. I can put one on by 4 o'clock today if we needed to. And quite honestly, when you're the one who's lost their job, we need to.
Maybe a very obvious question, but could you mention the sectors that have been involved in those 14 and then also the regions within the state? I'm imagining that most are in the more populated area, less populated area, but is there a trend there?
There is. A lot of what I was surprised to see was in the e-commerce arena. A lot of consolidation going on where you had, during COVID, everything was having to be delivered, and there were a lot of separate contracts. Now they have key partners such as Amazon and other types of shipping industries taking those contracts back and bringing those internal delivery of e-commerce locally for themselves. As a result, I would say at least 4 of the businesses this year were doing nothing but delivery for e-delivery and are no longer in business as a result of that. The other that I'm seeing is consolidation and just people kind of making adjustments in order to keep the building open and the business thriving. TD Bank, for example, ended up closing 6 of their branches. Most people are doing stuff online. The nice part about that one was we were given way advanced notice. And Commissioner Capato's one of them, working with the banking industry, a lot of times they don't share a lot of information. This time they did. We were able to reach out to the New Hampshire Bankers Association, make sure that they were working with the bank to ensure that as many of those people working on site were able to get other jobs either at TD Bank or other banking locations that was still had openings. I think out of the 70-some-odd people that was there, I think 12 ended up not finding work, and it was because they didn't want to either transport to the location that was available or they decided to retire. Did that answer your question, sir?
Yep. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Dave.
Yes.
With regards to businesses that you visited and responded to when things were heavy for you, have any of them gone back in business? Do we try to help them get back up on their feet?
You know, unfortunately, what I'm witnessing is the damage that had been done was so severe that they did not reopen. Most of those, quite honestly, were the smaller businesses. Some of the bigger businesses were either able to consolidate or have another buyer. The one noticeably, Coffee Cup, that closed abruptly. If I can say it, I just speak a little blunt here. I'm a little miffed at the way they did that because it affected 27 of our drivers that delivered product to various different grocery stores that aren't, that make a slim margin on food sales as it is. That company has since been bought,
right,
but the impact has still been done. So I'm seeing a lot of that take place, but it's still a worker that kind of gets caught up in the middle of that, which is why the services that we provide as a state are so important.
Thanks.
Yes, sir.
You mentioned interactivity of your website. Critical for people coming in from the outside to work their way through the process.
Yes.
How would you grade that right now as it is, as far as A to Z, going from this where you start and this is where they're bringing you to all the places to apply or put your resume out for?
Well,
if you had to grade that
process. So I can tell you what Joe told me when we first looked at the website. He said, this is unacceptable. And I said, okay, let's fix it. And I said, okay, who fixes it? And he goes, you. So, and that actually was very empowering because you know a lot of people in the state that it can do it. So before, I would have said a solid D minus because it had basic information that could point you in the right direction. But now it literally walks you through it. So if all of a sudden I'm sitting here thinking to myself, I'm a father of two, I've got a house mortgage on the way, I just lost my job, I just watched this video, but there's a number I can call. It's my face, it's my phone number, Joe's number. We want people to call us if they freeze up, because that 5 minutes that we spend with them on the phone, we'll point them right back into the direction. So right now, because I haven't seen it tested enough, I would say B+. But of course our goal is, I'm a 4.0 graduate, so 4.0 is the only thing I'm going to accept, because that's where we're heading. And of course, the other thing too that I would encourage each of you to do is tell people about the website and get them up there and using it. The young men and women that just sat up here this morning or this afternoon and told us their story, these are the same training programs that are available through our Rapid Response Partnerships, this Located Worker Program, all these great programs that we offer.
Other questions? Hearing none, thank you, Jim, so much.
Thank you.
Okay, program performance update, Lisa Girard.
Sorry to bury you all with paper.
Thank you.
This is how voting our regional. It's the PY20 Quarter 3 performance update. So this encompasses all of the Title I programs, which are adults, continued worker, and youth. Title II, adult education, currently does not have a system that we can gather data from, so they are not completed. But Title III, Wagner Kaiser, and Title IV, vocational rehabilitation, is also completed. So currently on the quarter, July 24-3, we meet or exceed most measures. There are a few that are under, that we do not meet them on. However, that is a direct relationship to what we are dealing with out in the field, the COVID, all of the other things that go along with it. We also had case management system change this year, so our field staff are working on trying to get all of the information incorrectly. However, program to date, we meet or exceed all performance measures across the board.
Okay, questions? Questions from the board members? Give everybody a minute or two here.
So in regards to that employment rate, second and fourth quarter, Because Job Corps uses the same exact thing. So are you using like a survey kind of?
No, not for the performance measure. That data is collected through our PSHA unit at Employment Security. And they actually, they create, gather that data and put it into the program.
Okay.
So the only data that we collect via like customer surveys is basically non-reportable or non-performance measure data.
Anything else, anybody? Hearing nothing, thank you so much, Lisa. Program success stories, we don't have any presentation from staff. Outdoor recreation and workforce development attraction, Tyler Ray and Scott Crowder. Thank you for joining us.
And folks on the board, the separate packet here that's found is where you would find their presentation and members of the public that document here.
Perfect. Hello, everyone. It's good to be here today, Joe. Thank you and thank you for having me. My name is Scott Crowder. I'm the director of the Office of Outdoor Recreation and Youth Development at EDA. I'm excited to be here today with Tyler Ray, the director of the recreation industry, economy, and workforce initiatives that we have going here. So, quick background on the Office of Outdoor Recreation and Youth Development. With the creation of this office, we've become the 16th state to have an office solely focused on outdoor recreation. I went into the role in March, and for the last 2.5 months, have conducted a little bit of a listening tour of sorts with industry stakeholders across the state to identify key players, learn more about the challenges the industry is facing, also have opportunities to describe us. Also, had some amazing conversations outside of the state, learning more about how other states are positioning outdoor recreation and leveraging the assets to support what's going on in those states. We're also taking a deep look at some trends at the regional and federal level of outdoor recreation. So, for some context, looking at outdoor recreation, the industry is usually framed up with four pillars. These include conservation stewardship, business and economic development, education and workforce, and health and wellness. So all those pillars currently exist here within our state. Obviously, each are at different levels of maturity and development. Throughout a lot of my conversations that I've had over the 2.5 months, one of the hot topics that have come up a lot was education and workforce and the need for support, and obviously the excitement that the industry has for the potential that it holds for the future. So a couple of examples, there's a company up in Littleton called Adventure Ready Brands. They own a number of outdoor recreation brands and products. They distribute them and sell them globally. They have trouble filling their open positions. They recently bought a company in Montana. They wanted to move it here to New Hampshire, decided against it because of the workforce challenges that they have. Had some conversations with the directors of Ski New Hampshire, and they voiced their challenges of hiring trained and competent mechanics to work on their lifts and groomers across their resort operations. On the other side of the equation, I heard of a company called Simbex in Lebanon. They produce devices in the healthcare and medical field. They actually take out ads in mountain bike magazines for open job positions that they have because of the trail assets that we have in the Humboldt Valley. Another example of a company doing great things is a company in Dover called Nemo. They produce outdoor recreation products, and they have a bike wall because a lot of their staff tries their bikes before. So these are just a couple of examples of some of the challenges in the workforce space that's hurting the industry, but also some examples of companies and ways that we can support and use the assets, the amenities, and the access that we have for our benefit. Some states are doing it really well. An example of this is Utah. Their report just came out specific to the tech sector employee and the main reason why Utah's tech sector is growing and expanding and becoming a prominent player with their economy is their tech sector employees' desire and draw to have the access to the outdoor recreation employment. So I think we're uniquely positioned here in New Hampshire to develop. To support the outdoor recreation economy by developing these career pipelines, establishing these educational programming, and it's only going to go to support our businesses, our communities, and New Hampshire as a whole. So we have an opportunity, I think, to position New Hampshire as the premier place to live, work, and play on the East Coast, and I think we can do it on the backs of outdoor recreation. So but there's a lot here, so I'm going to pass it over to Tyler Ray for him to share a little bit more about the Granite House Alliance, some of the roles and some of the impact of outdoor recreation on the economy in New Hampshire, and some of the workforce initiatives that we'd like to start to roll out to support not only the outdoor recreation industry, but also the other industry sectors here.
That's a quick
question. Sure.
You're tying into the private industry that's outdoor recreation. How is the combination with the state run businesses like state parks or ski resorts? You're tying into that also?
Sure. So, I mean, my office specifically is part of the EA. I mean, we're working in conjunction with the Department of Culture and Natural Resources to gain to kind of do a rising tide with all ships that run the outdoor recreation.
Good question.
Yes, that's my thing.
Thanks, Scott. My name is Tyler Ray, for the record. Greetings, everyone. Appreciate you having me here. It's a great opportunity. I'm the Managing Director of Granite Outdoor Alliance. And it certainly is a pleasure to be in person, I guess, one way to say it. In fact, Scott and I were, last Friday, we were with Senator Hassan over in Hanover at an event, and I never felt so good to hand out a business card before. So good to have a little interact. So at any rate, I'm short, so I'll dive right into it here. The reason we're here is to make the case, as Scott said, set the framework up for the industry, make a case for the outdoor recreation industry, and to request support for workforce initiatives with additional support, specifically pathway programs and talent attraction tools. The sector has an incredible opportunity to be a highly productive industry in New Hampshire, and I think as a flow through this presentation, I'm going to lay out some numbers and you'll see why it's a powerful economic engine that is outdoor recreation. And so what our ask is essentially a time-limited program that can help, as Scott said, lift all ships. And we like to use that term a lot just because it makes a lot of sense for us. But we like to have a time-limited program that utilizes the best practices that have been learned from other industries and the SBI programs and apply them to the outdoor recreation space. We would look at up to a three-year program, and that would create a sustainable program for creating a robust outdoor workforce. So there is a slide deck here that was handed out, so I'll just let you know when I'm moving along. Just know when I flip the page, just so you can follow along. The only thing we're lacking here is big screen. There's some really awesome pictures in here, but I see it is in color, so that's a good step. That's a good workshop. So if you haven't heard, the outdoors is booming, and having a moment. And of course, you know, all of us being New Hampshire here, that's really most surprised. New Hampshire heritage activity is the outdoors. But it's often viewed through a lens of tourism. And in our view, we'd like to shift that economic model and talk about the outdoors in a different way. And that's, and what we mean by that is we think outdoor assets are underutilized in the state. They have legs, they can go longer, do more things. And we think, as Scott referenced, that the state is uniquely positioned to capitalize on that. So this is an opportunity that's presented to us. And it's part of a key economic strategy. And that strategy is very simple. It's leveraging natural assets to improve the economy. very, very simple, but it's done in a variety of ways. But next slide. But what I want to do too is give a little shock and awe on this presentation, and that's this next page. And this picture had a noise, you know, come on real fast and be nice and loud and grab your attention. But the numbers are going to do that for you now anyway. $788 billion industry. Okay, this is nationwide. This is massive. It is powerful and massive. 5.2 million jobs, 2.1% of GDP. Outdoor industry is bigger than pharmaceuticals, auto, mining, agriculture. I mean, these comparables, I think, illustrate what we're talking about. And it provides that some of you out there that are visual thinkers, this is big time stuff. And it's on par with broadcasting and telecommunications. And I just want to say, like, you might be thinking to yourself, well, you know, we've been had the outdoors here in New Hampshire for hundreds of years, probably. You know, thanks for bringing this to our attention. Well, guess what? 2017, the REC Act was a federal act approved by Congress, and that authorized the measurement of the industry. So it wasn't until 2018, 2019 that we started to see empirical evidence. Otherwise, I wouldn't even be here, because we wouldn't have this evidence. I'd be back to my old ways of anecdotally telling stories and, you know, trying to provide the illustration. Now I have numbers. And so here we are. And this is an exciting time for this industry, and it's an exciting time for the state. And so our ability to measure is also our ability to develop policy surrounding this. So flipping the page, let's talk about answer. Again, shock and awe, wow factor going on here. $2.8 billion spending, 37,000 jobs, $1.3 billion in wages, $528 million in tax revenue generated, and 3.2% of the overall economy is in outdoor recreation. That's the ninth highest rate in the country. So it is certainly here, and it's certainly present. So I want to flip the page, but now I want to talk about the opportunity. So here's why outdoor recreation can and will be successful. I've already set the case for it being an unrecognized powerhouse. It's sort of this thing that I would say is hidden in plain sight, right? It's all around us. We all bike or walk in the woods with your dog or bird watch or jump off cliffs. Everyone knows different stuff, right? But it's all getting outside. And so it's unrecognized because it's cross-sector and multi-dimensional. It requires the interplay of different industries, and that is secret sauce. That's what's really important. Definitely a takeaway to think about as we leave here today. But it's also grounded in local communities. This is important stuff because it demonstrates its organic nature. So what the industry does is it captures wealth locally. It's not just tourism of a visitor economy. It wants to capture and retain that local wealth. Supporting small business renaissance, the other industry is largely made up of small to medium-sized companies, the mom-and-pop shops, if you will, the, you know, bike shop down the street, the craft beer, you know, brewery in town. You know, these are places people go, and they're sustainable because locals want that generative economy locally. And what it does is it attracts talented employees. As Scott mentioned, there's an opportunity to be, if you're near a location on the East Coast, for this live, work, play methodology and economic model. And that's really it. It's attractive. And no places like New Hampshire and the East Coast that has this mixture of ocean, the mountains, the lakes, and so forth. And so, you know, that's what leveraging natural resources and economic growth is. So it happens in a variety of ways. So turn the page. I want to raise attention to Granite Outdoor Alliance. The Granite Outdoor Alliance is a trade group that's developed. It was formed in the fall of 2020 after about a year or so of development. And even prior to that, I was on Commissioner Caswell's steering committee to develop Scott's position back in 2017 or 18, and here we are.
Thank you.
Awesome. And so the industry partners with Granite Outdoor it's a trade group, right? But it's reflective of the ecosystem that's in the outdoor industry. It's companies across the famous industry. It's goods and services, manufacturing, retail, arts and entertainment, and hospitality, et cetera. Nonprofit, land trust, educators, government. So it's really a nice mix. Currently, we have 50 members to the organization, and that's after essentially starting in earnest in January. So in a short, 5 months stint, we've captured quite a few, and that's been the real initial focus to build recruitment and network impact. So people need the buy-in to have that impact. So now I want to shift into what the landscape looks like, flip the page, and then we'll get to the meat of the pitch. So the current workforce landscape, and I will say that this is really an outcome of being tourism dependent, that we have a highly service-oriented economy with high seasonality, which means high transiency, which means turnover, and means low retention, right? You can see how this goes, which also means low wages. And so, this is something that we're sort of tackling, right? It's like when you have the visitor economy of tourism creating a demand-side economic model, well, now we'll work on the back, we want the backfill. We need to work on the workforce side of things, because that was something that wasn't necessarily contemplated in depth. Because the outdoors has been the outdoors. It's never been valued in this way. So it's been used, not leveraged, okay? So it's been an untapped resource. So flipping the page, here's the real meat of our pitch, and we like to look at this in four ways. The first being very pathway-centric focus, and the balance being more related to recruitment and attraction of talented employees. So going to number one, it's the industry workforce skill sets that must be improved through special career and technical education programs. And that's in collaboration with aligned industries. Remember I said that the outdoor industry is a collection of other industries. And it's promoting existing job pipelines and currently jobs that aren't existing in New Hampshire. There's a real opportunity. And I want to bring focus to a couple of examples. We saw 2 weeks ago in the the Union Leader, there were 11 new bike shops that have popped up in city of Concord this spring. Not statewide, but this spring here in Concord, 11. Okay? So, I'm sort of tagging some indicators here of where things are trending and going. Then you can, the workforce, the bike mechanics that can, help with that. You can't buy a bike right now, so maybe if you're lucky in November because of things are back ordered. But anyway, that's happening here in Concord. Shot mentioned the Adventure Ready Brands. This is a multinational corporation that has a slew of open positions up in Littleton, and they don't have a skilled workforce. They can't fill these positions in Littleton. And these examples range up and down the scope here, but I'm just trying to lay out what we need to tackle. In Littleton, they had a project Bike Tech, which was the beginnings of a DE program at Littleton High School and on a regional basis, and it was training students on bike mechanics. You have Mount Washington Valley, right? So now we're in a different part of the state. We have, I was just contacted recently, the Mount Washington Valley Technical Career Center is applying for a grant to incorporate outdoor recreation at the CTE pathway program, and that's specifically bike mechanic repair and trail construction. So these are emerging areas that different areas of the state are focusing on unrelatedly. So Scott and I have also been working with various educational partners, including UNH, Grand State, Plymouth State, and et cetera. And there's a lot of energy in that space to develop the CTE pathway programs. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention the big one, which the one that is statewide, that there's two pieces of legislation, SB 148 and SB 90, that are, one is focused on outdoor recreation, incorporating outdoor recreation into education, and the other being proposing outdoor recreation as an actual CTE pathway program. So these things are actually happening now, but they're going at it alone, and that's something that we don't believe that isolated action is going to be profitable for the industry. We want to see it come together, facilitate a larger network. So that is the pathway program that we're identifying, and I'll talk about some occupations there in a minute. I just want to briefly touch on entrepreneurial facility talent, entrepreneurial business, that's developing incubators, you know, things of that nature, harnessing the energy that's in this space, and it could come from tech, manufacturing, so forth. I mean, there's a lot of energy, so we want to bring that into the answer. Creating an online marketing marketplace is all about connectivity, right? So we have an outdoor recreation segment that we need to overcome geographical boundaries. So creating, ways to do that online is really important. That's different than other industries. And then finally, infrastructure. Scott mentioned earlier that there's a couple of examples, actually, but the biggest one, Utah, all the workers in their workforce assessment study, 76% of the workers were there because of outdoor recreation. So, sure, we have mountains, we have lakes and all that stuff that I referenced, but if you can't access it, if you can't get to it, if you can't, it's more, trails, are littered, and those are problems, right? So it's cleaning up the backyard and presenting a backyard that is built up and ready for the workforce to become attractive. So flipping then to the next page, is what I just listed out a few of these occupations. What do they look like, right? Let's get some context going here. So the technical trades are obviously a big one, and that's really the focus of where we're here today. And that's more in the bike and motorized mechanical world, ski technicians, ski lift, summit, ski manager. Met with the snowmobile and ATV groups, the e-snowmobiles, e-ATVs, that's hard to say, e-ATVs. That's a big place. So you have, we've had the surge of people coming in and recreating, but we don't have the backdoor, we don't have the workforce to support that, so it's really important. And I won't list out the rest, but you can read those. And flipping the page, just lastly, to reemphasize that outdoor recreation, it does span industries, including those that are currently supported in the sector partnership initiative here. And it adds a whole new dimension of collaboration, productivity, and opportunity. And it's an incredible opportunity. So, ORID, Scott's office, and Grand Outdoor are looking to use the best practices that SPI has learned and developed and apply them to the outdoor recreation sector for career pathways and talent attraction. So in a time-limited type program, as I mentioned at the outset, say up to 3 years, we would be able to develop sustainable industry programs and improvements that would create that robust outdoor workforce. Thank you. Any questions?
So I'm looking at the industries. You got five in here. Four of them, doctors provide, students that can absolutely be contributing to the workforce. What I'm really struggling with finding later on transportation for these new graduates to actually get a job. So if there's nothing related to them, you're talking about 16 to 24, be ready to absolutely take on any challenge, but give them driver license, but they don't have the money to buy a vehicle, or there's no transportation to go from point A to point B. And I think that's also like another concern that can assist if we can address that.
Susan, I would assume that probably being felt across the board in all industries, right? Just the challenge of public transportation or transportation for each individual. But I don't know if we would have a solution for that. Obviously, I think what we see the outdoor rec industry being is playing a supporting role in some of these other industries that are already flourishing in the state. I think a lot of what is in front of us is almost storytelling and controlling the narrative. Utah, for example, is considered Silicon Slopes, not Silicon Valley, right? It's like there's a way to attract people with a way of life, and I think a lot of people choose to live here in New Hampshire because of that way of life, the access to the outdoor amenities. So I just think we need to tell that story in a more compelling way. But obviously, we're started to flourish in the tech sector and in remote work if they had access. Obviously, Silicon folks, you know, have that, so they're able to have these businesses move there from there. That's a great point, and I don't know if you've heard of transportation issues in your conversation.
Yeah, no, I echo what you said. There's a lot of challenges in front of us, and that's certainly right there. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes.
So I will piggyback off of his about transportation. I don't know if you're aware of it, but in Claremont we have an Amtrak stop, and they use the Vermonter line as their pilot program for transporting bikes on the train. So we've had people come from all populated points along the eastern seaboard from here down to D.C., hopping on the train with their bike. They get off in the Claremont stop with their bike because they've got a lot of biking trips in that area, both on the New Hampshire and Vermont side, and then they take off. The point being is that we can establish transportation system that allows people who are advocates of the outdoors to get from point A to point B easily with their equipment, not so to try to make to remove the barriers and make it simpler. The rail trail system is another issue. People would like to ride their bike, you know, we have wonderful rail trails. However, they're not uniformly maintained. So you could be riding your bike somewhere along the line, and then you get to a segment of the trail system that's very sandy. It's not conducive to certain bikes. But if you can create opportunities for people to experience the outdoors in a very simple manner, not necessarily get on the bank without a plane, and then have to rent the equipment, which I know probably is on the downside of the business segment of what you're trying to accomplish. That's one comment. The other comment is, you mentioned community colleges and state universities as pathways for creating that work. But what about the sector?
Yes, that's absolutely. He also mentioned that part of it. Working actively now, and that was part of the legislation he's referenced. And, oh, yeah, absolutely.
There's good movement there. There's a company that just started at Plymouth that uses technology for people to rent high quality gear, and it's all turnkey. You show up and you pick it up, you go out, and they're booming, they're growing. Young kid started and ran out of college, great stuff. There's a company in Boston that sole focus is promoting outdoor recreation activities, and then providing carpool and transportation to get to it. And the majority of their outings are up here in New Hampshire. So we don't have all the answers, but I think there's definitely some ways to maybe alleviate it. It's a big number. I mean, I think it's 75% of people that outdoor do something inside or doing it within 10 or 20 miles of their house. So it's not necessarily somebody that's needing to travel to it. And improving the infrastructure too. I mean, somebody to go out and hit a rest trail, or somebody to go to hit a trail system that a land truck has set up. We want to make sure that the assets are there and available.
Okay, before we move on to additional questions, I know you folks are here as an informational item, but is there something else that we can do for them, that we're looking to do for them, or as a group, or Joe, maybe you might want to address that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So we have some additional funds that could be made available for a program concept, and from a staff perspective, we'd like an opportunity to work on with Tyler and Scott on some program concept and bring it back to the board. If we could get, if that's agreeable to the board, or if there would be a motion or a consensus, just so as staff we can dedicate appropriate time to next steps.
Why don't we make a motion, if everybody's amenable to that? Why don't we make a motion while we still have a quorum? Okay, so
I'll make a motion that the staff proceed with coming back with a concept that we could look at further.
Okay.
I'll second it.
Okay. Motion made and seconded.
Do you mind stating your names?
I'm sorry, Mike Summers, yeah. Made motion.
And Dave.
Dave Coffey.
Coffey.
Yeah. Anything else? Motion made and seconded. Any discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion abstained. Motion carries unanimously. Thank you. Any other questions before they step away?
I had a comment. I'm from Hanover. We have the Appalachian Trail that goes through. Business that I used to operate and own was the Dartmouth Bookstore, and we used to get hikers in there all the time. One of the things that's going on now in the area is that you get a lot more people coming through on the Appalachian Trail, and folks who have big houses and not a lot of kids around are now saying, look, we've got places for these people to stay if they want to spend a couple days in Hanover, find out what it's like, and go out and dine and that sort of thing. And that's beginning to mushroom. The Appalachian Trail goes through the back of my property, and I'm out there quite often working on my sugaring trails or other things, and I run into these people, and they talk about how much they've enjoyed the downtown. There are plenty of places to eat and that sort of thing. And that's building these, I think maybe they call them trail angels, where, if you want to spend the night, you don't have to pay for it, along with the fraternities and so on. Other thing is that in Hanover, we have a non-profit organization called the Hanover Improvement Society. Are you familiar with that? No. Basically, it started out as a movie theater in the downtown that was donated to the town. The town didn't want to run it, so the organization was put together, Hanover Improvement Society. Nugget Theater was the cash cow that soon was able to develop Storrs Pond. Storrs Pond is a recreational area for the local people. We have campsites, and the camping sites have just this year almost all taken all summer long now. It's hard to get a reservation at those campsites, 15 to 20 of them, and we have a disc golf area right around it, things to do. The folks who run that in the summer, the key staff, then switch over to the camping and ice rink, which we have in Hanover. The Improvement Society runs. And then they fill the voids with the part-time students who are coming home. Like right now, Storrs Pond can't open fully until all the kids come back, because we need them, lifeguards, run the concession, and that sort of thing. So those things as you just pointed out, it's not so much people coming in from everywhere. The local people are finding out more about these things, and they're using up the campsites.
For sure. I think one of the, probably call it a silver lining of COVID, I think it put people outside, and it was trending in that direction the last summer with the pandemic. I mean, the numbers were through the roof, and I think it reintroduced people to activities that they may have done in the past, or was a actual just first impression for people. And I think we're going to see more and more of this, because that's probably where physicians to hopefully take advantage of this.
Yeah, and there are organizations out there who do fix the trails, like the Upper Valley Trail Alliance. If Joe throws some money out, those people can use it to connect trails and make the trails easier to handle. Well, that's that's a possibility.
Good one. Anybody? Anything else? Anybody want to bring up? If not, I'm sorry.
I do.
Yeah, sure.
To whom it would be best directed. But there are so many opportunities within local communities, Claremont being one, but there's many for us to take. But the communities themselves don't always have the resources, the finances to place these natural resources in the condition that we would like them to be. And we have, for instance, we have a boat ramp on the Connecticut River. We have been waiting years to get the state fishing game to do what it says it wants to do. Everybody wants to do it.
Right.
The state doesn't have the resources, the local community doesn't have the resources to dredge out the boat ramp and have it accessible both to people from out of state as well as in state. And I just wonder, with this concept, how is that part of the equation going to change? You know, the assets that belong to communities, and they don't necessarily have the resources to bring them up to the condition that would be an attraction to people who would like to participate in whatever those activities are.
Yeah, I would say, bandwidth and financing, of course, those are big capacity building issues that certainly is high on our priority list. It's part of it in the system that we're in,
which
we value. So, when you say, we value roads and bridges, and we even apply and have to value those, and there's some maintenance to leave
that. Yeah, other things. But I think we're also in the moment, so we need to do it.
So, the pattern list is, well, let's apply that same rationale for the outdoor infrastructure. So, and so that there is a funding source to keep infrastructure at a level that is attractive or, lack of a better term, something that provides that access, that does what it's supposed to do. That's a funding mechanism that is maybe outside the scope of this conversation, but that's definitely something we're tackling. And a lot of different industries have different ways to finance improvements, and the outdoor industry. I want to reemphasize that. Yes, the outdoors has been around a long time, but it has not been viewed from a perspective of an economic strategy prior. So this is all emerging rationales, and different states have different ways they've tackled it. Yes, to create funding mechanisms to improve infrastructure.
There's a big conversation across the country right now to actually look at outdoor recreation infrastructure at that and create those streams. The Great American Outdoor Act, which was passed last year, funded in perpetuity in the Landowner Conservation Fund, and talking with the Department of Agricultural Resources, those funds are going to increase over the next few years because of that act. One of the things that my office can step in and do, because we're hearing that with a lot of our community members, is how do you navigate these grant processes, and how do you get the money so that we can actually fix something that people want to use, right? I think the issue for the longest time is you make an investment in it, but you don't think of the maintenance on it. And all of a sudden, it's 30, 40 years later, and you have a rundown bathroom house and a boat ramp that's cracking or whatever. So, big piece of it. Obviously, that's the giant money in outdoor recreation right now. And now you're starting to frame out what the industry actually is and the challenges that the industry faces. And I think part of it is.
And if you think about it, just to add on to that, how historically things are done. Usually, sort of as a result of funding going to other things, you create this nonprofit volunteerism type system that is easily said to be unsustainable because it requires, you know, there's a burn rate on people's individual ability. We like to say, you know, how many bake sales does it take to build that parking lot or that, you know, that canoe launch? I mean, it's that doesn't make any sense. Particularly like a state like New Hampshire that, you know, 3.2% of that is of its GDP is in, you know, the outdoor rec space, which is one of the top 10 in the nation. So there's a way to figure that out, but it's also how what we value, you know, as a citizenry. So that's part of our campaign of awareness and, you know, trying to drive that. So it's a big bite, all of this, but I, you know, takeaway I think is that it's an exciting time. Scott said, I think we've all have spent a little bit more time outdoors recently, but when you start to see how, you know, economic activity around outdoor pursuits, how that is quantified, it's real numbers. So leave it at that. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. Okay, next we're going to go to the subcommittee reports, bylaw subcommittee report. Jonathan, he's got a quick report to give.
Yes, I'll go quick. So on May 10th, we met to discuss some changes to the bylaws. I think last time we had even looked at the bylaws was 2016. So time to do some updates over the past years, both workforce policies within the state, but federally they had changed a bit. So we looked at what those changes were and in working, you know, I know Joe and his team, they worked with the U.S. Department of Labor to gain some insights on what other states were doing and worked on implementing some best practices. We also worked with some of our partner states or other states with similar organizations, I think Idaho, Colorado, and Washington,
yep,
were the three. I know in the vast amount of papers that we all received today, there are copies of what we as a committee came forward with in terms of some updates to the bylaws. These have also been run by DOJ as well, so they've given kind of their sign-off on them. And I know we, in terms of our current bylaws, we can't vote on these new bylaws today. We're just simply presenting them to the rest of the members of SWIB, and then I think the plan is, you know, should everyone think that they're good, the plan would be to vote and adopt the new bylaws at our next meeting. Joe, anything that you want to add?
Yeah. So this is, we're following the process very carefully. So we had to first start with the bylaws committee. As we talked about the last meeting, we put together a small volunteer group. You see the members. It was Jonathan Melanson, Kelly Clark, and
Julie Demers.
Thank you. Sorry. And so we started with that, and we've kind of gone through the double check, like Jonathan mentioned, on the Department of Justice. So in order to be complying with our current bylaws, we have to present it here today for conversation, for review. No vote can take place today. Certainly, if folks have ideas or whatever, if you want to take a look or however the board pleases to go through it, but we have to present it here today publicly so everybody has notice. You find, again, these are included here, but also to the public and for a vote at the October 19th meeting, which was those dates were voted upon by the board in February.
Thoughts of the board. How would you like to proceed? Any questions, any thoughts after going? Have you had a chance to go through this? Okay. All right. So why don't we give them the opportunity to go through it and report back to you as far as any thoughts or suggestions that anybody might have? How's that sound? Everybody good with that? Okay. Okay. Next, review subcommittee report, Dave Choffey.
Well, basically, what we have been doing is looking at and have finally finished the request for proposals around the state. And if you went through the minutes, page 37 through 41 will give you an idea of what our programs are going to be that are financed. what we basically tried to do was to spread the money out a little more geographically. But of course, taking a look at the industries in the areas and the unemployment rate, and whether if we put money in the area, do we have enough potential to attract folks to be trained. And that's basically where we went. And as I said, pages 37 to 41 in the minutes will give you an idea of where we are spending money. And then on top of that, one of the things that came up recently and we talked about just the other day, we didn't fund a program in Peterborough. One of the reasons was because there were a lot of technical errors in their proposal. You have to be very specific sometimes, you know, and cross every T and dot every I. And so, and they were even applying in the wrong district. I think they were applying in West Central when in fact they're in Hillsborough. But anyway, we're trying to fix that because that area does have a fairly high unemployment rate, not so much in Peterborough, but in a couple of the towns around like Fitzwilliams and Sharon. And we're hoping we're going to be able to put a program there. And one of the reasons is because there, I think it's my turn that was interested in running a program there for about 25 youth. And that was where they would start and begin to build up from there. And what you need in an area like that is a couple of employers who will help out. And in that area, we've got New Hampshire Ball Bearing, and then there's the Monadnock Community Hospital. And what that would translate into is the training people in healthcare, human services, and even some technology, and obviously the trades. And the Upper Valley Community College also operates in that area, so they would be helpful. And then, of course, there's Tamer and his job corps, and he's willing to bring people anywhere if you give them a job. So we thought that would be a good place to perhaps spend some money, and that's being considered. But that gives you an idea of what we are looking for before we approve a program and spend money. And hopefully where we have designated the money to go, it will be productive.
Great. Thank you. Questions at all? The board?
So, is your primary indicator about where the money should go based on unemployment rate?
No, not necessarily. It's the other things, too. But you definitely need to have the potential to use that money and make it productive. So you look at a lot of things. That's one of the factors you have to consider. And the unemployment rate around the state is, as well, as our commissioner can tell us, amen. there are a lot of jobs out there. I think I read something the other day where there are 9.1 million jobs across the USA, and there's only 8 million unemployed people. Or no, it goes the other way around. 8 million jobs, 9.1 million unemployed people, but they don't want to go get those jobs. Are we running into that in New Hampshire?
Well, what I wanted to do, and I've got Sarah Morrissey here with me too, I just wanted to introduce Sarah. She's the New Employment Services Director back there. She took Pam Zajic's place. I'm sure many of you know Pam, who had been with the agencies 29 years. And Sarah's got a great background, and she was a office manager out in Portsmouth and then assistant director to Pam, and now she is the director. So I wanted to give just a brief report because I know Taylor was scheduled to be here. He wasn't able to be around. But I just want to talk, first off, you know, what a great partnership we've got with BEA, and we've been doing these virtual job fairs all over the state. BEA assists us tremendously in finding employers to attend the job fairs, and as far as the job seeker numbers have gone up substantially from where we were. I mean, at one point prior to the work search coming back into place and the fact that the federal programs are going to end on June 19th, we were averaging somewhere around 40 or 50 people turning out to these virtual job fairs. And there'd be somewhere along the lines of 4,000 jobs available. So that number has shot up. I mean, as far as the job seekers go,
We get anywhere from 500 to 1,000 people showing up to these job fairs now. And we're doing, we have three scheduled this week. We had one today, and you had 600-700 people when you were on? And so the numbers have shot way up, and we've got two others this week. We're doing them on all the regions all over the state. We have them on the Seacoast, the Lakes region, the Monadnock region, and the Capital and Southern region as well. And we're doing them all over the state. The unemployment rate right now is 2.8%, which is terrific. The numbers, the claim volume has dropped substantially from, you know, back in May of last year, we were at 117,000 continued claims a week. And right now, in the beginning of May, we were at 34,000. We're at 25,000 now, and it's still dropping. So next week, on Tuesday of next week, the new unemployment rate will come out for the month of May. But everything is moving in the right direction. You know, we've still got a ways to go, but from where we were, I mean, at 17% unemployment, we've made a you know, tremendous rebound. The state's made a tremendous rebound. They got a tremendous team in place, and everybody basically has worked extremely hard at the agency as well as, you know, BEA and all the state agencies in order to get this done and get what we needed to get done for the citizens of the state. Just to give you an idea, in a sense, we've paid out just under $1.9 billion throughout this pandemic, which is more than the previous 10 years that we've paid out in unemployment combined. So to keep up at that rate, we've, like I said, they've done a tremendous job. Normally, we would be meeting in the New Hampshire Works office, you know, at our building, at the Toby building. I asked Joe for a reprieve for this one meeting, and we can go back there in October. But right now, it's sort of still like a battle zone. You know, it was a call center, so you've got wires and everything still all over the place. We're in the process of cleaning that up, but we've got another contractor in place that is assisting us with the call center, and that's going to continue. They've had over a million calls that they've taken at the call center. So volume has been incredible. And like I said, initially when this happened, we weren't able to ramp up. So basically everybody in the agency was doing overtime, you know, and the overtime was the equivalent to about 95 additional positions. And then by summertime, last summer, we were able to ramp up and add some positions. But, you know, at the start of this, if you're dealing with a recession, that's one thing. You're able to add positions. You're dealing with a pandemic that you've never had to deal before. There is no time to ramp up and get new positions in place. So everybody basically stepped up to the plate. We were all working 7 days a week and just getting the job done for the citizens of the state. So. And with that, I'll take any question if anybody has any questions. Or Sarah, you want to add anything?
No, it's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to meet everyone. I'm really excited. I know, Commissioner Patterson, many of you probably worked with Pam Sajak for quite a long time. So I'm just looking forward to moving forward and building those relationships with you as well. So thank you again.
Jim.
Commissioner, I run the Greater Parker Chamber of Commerce. Thank you for that. And, you know, we spend a lot of time hand-holding businesses' hands, working with them and sort of serving as an information source. And we really had great success working with the department and helping businesses access the funds they needed. So.
Great. Good to hear. Thank you so much.
Richard, with the amount of money that's gone out of the unemployment fund the last year, based on the blackout, obviously, the state job training fund was financed out of that, which was $1 million a year. Has been passed on to the Department of Labor.
No, that's over with us now.
You guys,
that's over with us.
So, will that be impacted, that volume of dollars for the job training fund going down the road, since it was taken out of the unemployment fund?
No, there's
it's an excess.
The same amount of money is still available through
okay.
the job
okay.
training
plan
fund.
Plan
yes, plan. Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah, the only other thing that I would add is that, and you've probably seen how some states there was, I mean, everybody got hit with the whole fraud issue, and there was a significant amount of stolen identities, people that had everybody's names, full social addresses and all that, and, you know, you had some states, California, I think that the fraud they paid out was somewhere between $11 and $28 billion. in fraud that was paid out. New York State was over $1 billion. Washington State was somewhere around $600-700 million. And ours, out of the 1.9, it's probably about 1% that was paid out that was fraud. And everything else was caught. And, you know, there were numerous businesses and people that I knew that called me directly to say, hey, I got this claim. I never filed for unemployment, sure. And it was stolen identities. And but by the time I called BPC, which is our Benefit Payment Control division, by the time I called them, they had already caught it. And there were certain things, you know, there's certain things obviously on a claim that we're looking at to try to identify whether it's a clean claim or whether it's a fraudulent claim. And again, the department did a great job, staff did a great job catching that stuff. So we didn't get hit like other states did, thank God.
So that preserved the funds?
Pardon me?
That preserved the funds for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And most of the funds that were paid out of the 1.9, the overwhelming majority of those funds were federal funds.
Yeah.
You know, especially back during the initial time where you had the $600 add-on for anybody that was eligible. So if they were eligible up front back then, I mean, they were getting their unemployment benefit plus six. Plus 600. So
just anecdotally, you know, I know unemployment's in a great place. I think the real challenge, especially for the hospitality industry, is that we're in a crisis mode for workers. We're
sure.
At a point where businesses are shortening hours, closing days of the week, and so now it's, you know, it's kind of a catch-22 for them. They're coming out of a pandemic that just hammered the industry, and now they're in a position where they can't do the business that's in front of them because they don't have the workers to do the business. So we're just in this really tough spot. We're hearing, you know, jobs being posted for kitchen help at $22 an hour, $1,000 signing bonuses. So the jobs are there, the jobs are paying. And I'm not totally sure how we get folks into those jobs, but I think what it highlights for me is that we're right back where we were a year and a half ago, when we were screaming and yelling because
sure.
We didn't have enough jobs, and not just for our industry, it's across the network, the system. So I guess the broader question is, how do we as a workforce board, how are we going to start to, as a state, try to address that problem?
Well, I mean, I think part of what's going to happen here, too, is because the federal benefits are ending, so that's another 10,000 people that are going to come off unemployment benefits. And again, with us, I mean, what we're trying to do is we're trying to push as much as we can and do the job fairs statewide, do them by regions. And in addition to that, we've got the virtual job portal on our website as well as the job match system. And we're
I know, and
we want to be able to help you. Obviously, the discussion we had at the beginning.
Yeah.
Where I was telling you, I mean, I know restaurant owners that are telling me the same sort of thing, that I could have knocked it out of the park Memorial Day weekend, but I had to shut down a portion of the restaurant because I just didn't have enough help.
But I think I'm not flagging the job as being done. I think it's been an amazing job.
No, I know that. I know that.
I think what I'm saying is, and I think this is an issue we identified prior to the pandemic, is we don't have enough workers.
Right.
Period. So even if we had 100% of them back at work, we still wouldn't have enough workers. We'd be tens of thousands of people short in what we need in the system. And so I don't know what the solution is, but I just, you know, as a board, I don't know if that's something we should be talking about.
I don't see why not.
And Jordan, I expected you had the answer.
Off the top of my head, I don't have that answer on with me today.
Well, I mean, generally, I mean, the state of New Hampshire has to attract more people than our state.
Of course.
I mean,
it's
as simple as that. I mean, outdoor recreation will help that, but there's got to be a whole boost to people to come into the state and beyond.
And I think BA has done a great job with the advertising that they've done,
right.
You know, trying to attract people from other states to New Hampshire,
right.
And the reason you want to come here, you know.
Right.
I mean, you know, you think of the amount of time you save staying and coming to New Hampshire, staying here, and not having to drive down to Boston or whatever, and the amount of time that you lose driving to Boston, driving back, playing, paying mass tax, yeah, everything.
What,
yes, I'm sorry.
Parts of the country where there is higher unemployment, that if we were advertising for help, that we might get people relocated? Like, are we targeting specific? I can't think of a hard message.
I think the biggest problem is
South Dakota or something like that.
We don't have any housing stock. There's nowhere for them to live. That's the problem, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's a multiple problem. I mean, the housing stock, the rental housing is what? We're at 1%? About? Yeah. So.
So, Mike, are you seeing people not who have been in New Hampshire in the restaurant industry, and after this pandemic said, I don't want to do this anymore because
yes.
it was categorized as a, you know, non-essential, and or at least the workers themselves in the industry felt like they were non-essential.
We were listed as essential, and that's why we didn't really actually close. Again, business model shifted dramatically, but that aside, yes, we're seeing people shift out of our industry for a variety of reasons. One was that, you know, we did have massive layoffs, right, which is a little unnerving for families and humans, so I get that. But we've also had, because of those shifts, we've seen people have transitioned away from traditional employment. So we've seen a lot of people go into the gig economy. They figured out that they could make as much money driving for Uber Eats as they could working a regular job. So I think, and I think that's compounding the issue. I also think with the $300 federal benefits, I don't think that really affects full-time employment, but I think it affects part-timers. And I think that's where it gets really interesting, because if you just do the math in your head, if you were a parent in a family where you worked a couple of nights a week to kind of make ends meet or whatever, and you were working, call it 10 hours a week at $20 an hour, it's $160. You're getting paid $300 to not work that job. And again, I don't think that's going to be the panacea we all hope it will be.
$300 plus whatever their unemployment.
That's right. So I don't. Even when the $300 ends, I don't think it's going to be a groundswell of all of a sudden all of our problems are solved. I think we're just going to be back where we were prior to the pandemic, which was
right.
A really tough position to begin with. But I do think that what's happened is we're going to see that workforce has shifted. So we're going to see a lot of people are now in those entrepreneurial type, gig economy type things. People have decided, you know what, I'm tired of relying on other people. I'm going to do my own thing. So we see a lot more online IT type stuff. So I think there is just going to be a dramatic shift in how workforce or how a lot of young workers view working, right? And so because of that, how do the more traditional styles of businesses, manufacturing, you know, hospitality, some of those you have to kind of be there to participate in, how are we going to find our workforce? And I don't know that we have an answer to that right now.
Well, I think that's topic one for our October 19th meeting, right? You've got to start somewhere. So
for sure.
I think that, you know, that would be a good place to start. And the other thing is we could get Brian Gottlob, who's the economist with us, and, our economic labor market division, to put together some information for us for that meeting, you know, which would indicate, you know, you could put something together for industries, how much they lost, how much they've come back since the pandemic ended. But I think that's an area we could begin to address anyway.
Right, and now we're sitting here talking about outdoor economy, so we're going to be needing workers for the outdoor
sure.
economy. We've got folks talking about offshore wind. There's going to have to be a whole workforce developed around that. So we're tens of thousands of dollars people short now. How on earth are we going to grow into these? We're just not going to have the bodies. So.
Commissioner, do your jobs available numbers sort out seasonal jobs versus all year jobs?
He can do that. He can sort out seasonal. Yeah,
that would be interesting.
Yeah. Right now, as far as job postings, which we get that data from Burning Glass, we've got a contract with. It's called Burning Glass, and Brian Gottlob gets that information. It's somewhere around 23,000 to 24,000 jobs that are posted that aren't filled. The majority of which, of the 23 to 24, are in the healthcare industry. Yes, sir.
Because I don't understand the status of foreign workers and what percentage that do we rely on that in your industry, and what I know with the pandemic, obviously that space becomes a problem, but what percentage is that, and is that a resource for your industry?
It is a resource for our industry, and we've historically used it a lot. That's the J-1 and H-2B visa workers. The real challenge this year was H-2Bs, frankly, have been limited, the visa caps. I personally have been advocating with our congressional delegation to bring back the returning worker exemption, which used to be in place prior to 2016. Again, that's a policy of the White House that hasn't been adopted yet, but I know there's a lot of discussions and letters flying around in D.C. right now. You know, at one point, I think the H-2B program in the United States was north of 180,000 visa folks came in every season. And now I think we're capped at, somebody correct me, 60, 70, 80,000, something like that. So it's about half what it was at one point. J-1 visas are another avenue. The real problem with J-1s this year is a lot of the countries where we would normally source J-1s from have travel restrictions so that people can't get out of the country and come here. And on top of that, a lot of our consulates were closed, so they couldn't interview anybody to approve them to travel here anyway. I actually, surprisingly, ran into a member of ours up in Lincoln who told me they actually got all of their J-1 visas, and they were as surprised as I was. So, yes, it is certainly helpful. But as a percentage of the workforce, you know, in a good year, we're like 70,000 people or so, it's a relatively small percentage, and it's very seasonal, specifically most of them. But it's an important piece.
I have to apologize. I have to run out to pick up my son. So,
thanks, Mark. Thank you for coming. No, we're all set.
Did I leave or anything? Okay.
I knew you were leaving at 3. We took care of that already.
Thank you, everyone.
Take care.
Thank you.
Mike, to play off of what you said, and I don't know if you guys are hearing it yet, but from at least because parks, we rely on some J-1s to staff up our summer facilities. We're being told right now the wait time for an appointment within the Social Security Administration to get your Social Security number, that's at like a month right now.
That doesn't surprise me.
So.
Well, if you remember, White House and DOL released another 22,000 H-2B visas. Those were gone before they issued this one.
Sure.
Because the way that system works is a raffle system, right? So you basically apply and you get 4 chips. You get one in round A, one in round C, one in round D.
Yeah.
Well, all the A's were gone immediately. That was January 1st. And when they issued the other 22,000, I don't know, even know they got through B. So if you had a C and D, which there was a lot of folks in New Hampshire, it didn't really depend.
Yeah, I think we're going to have, I think, at least I know parts. We have J-1 visas here right now.
Yes, but not all that you asked for.
Not all, but some of them are here, but we can't have them work yet because we're waiting for their appointment.
And I think even with what H-2Bs may be coming on top of and the additional J-1s that are, they are starting to matriculate to the system, we're not going to get them, most of them, until July.
Yeah.
And by then, it's almost too late.
Right.
Yep.
Right.
So...
Okay. I mean, as far as topics, I mean, this obviously should be topic number one. I think that it concerns every employer in the state, and you know, I think that's...
It's not just seasonal employment either, right? We have full-time, year-round employment.
Yeah, you've got...
And if that's a resource for that, I've never tried out anything about how difficult is it, to find someone through that program or bring them into your company as a small business owner,
Well, it's not necessarily difficult, but it's time-consuming and it's expensive.
Yeah.
Because you essentially have to find a third party, essentially it's an attorney shop more often than not, and they have contacts and they will connect you with Homeland Security, and they're the ones that help you find candidates in the other country. They do the whole process. And then you as the business owner get to either, you know, Zoom interview them or whatever it might be, and then, yes, I'll take 1, 2, 3, 4. But then there's a whole process, and that process takes 3-4 months. Most people who are getting people now applied in November and December
of last year.
That's right. So they're about to start the process for next year.
I think it will be a little cheaper if we can get some carpooling for some of those applicants that want to work but they don't have transportation. Again, like I want to go back to Job Corps or any other JAG or MITRE or whatever, and there's a lot of youth between 18 and 24 that will take an entry-level job. Because right now, I think like some people left entry-level job when they're going to come back. They will pick because there's so many open positions that they're paying $20, $25 an hour versus $14, $15 an hour.
I find it hard to believe that where they live, they can't find a job within walking distance, because every business I talk to, doesn't matter the industry, has job openings right now.
Could do it.
I mean, there's a sign on every door. The state has so many open positions right now, it's kind of unnerving. So.
Yeah.
For other topics, Commissioner?
Sure.
We didn't in our motion have a expense date for the concept that they were going to bring forward. Is that anticipated to come before us in October or later on?
So we have a review committee of the SWIB, so we would first go to them prior to the October meeting, then brought before the entire SWIB for the October meeting. That's the plan. Would be the plan.
Be
yep.
As far as the other thing, I mean, if you have other topics you want to bring up for the October meeting, I think, you know, I mean, talking with everybody here, I think that's priority one, what we spoke about. But if there's other topics that you'd like to bring forth, either give them to Joe, call Joe, email Joe or whatever, and get those topics to Joe so we can put it on that agenda for October. Okay. Anything else anybody want to bring up? Yes.
I have a question with the job fairs. Is there a schedule on the website?
Yes.
It is. On which website?
On our website.
Okay. And are those job fairs in relationship at all to the other job fairs, like community colleges put on, or are they all? So I was wondering, how can you combine efforts? A lot of times you have individual organizations trying to do a better thing. So you're maximizing.
The community college is probably a resource, I'm assuming, at some of these job fairs. But I mean, we haven't, we're not in a position yet where we've gone out to actually do in-person job fairs yet, like we were doing in the past. You know, with the in-person job fairs, we had done several at the community college in Nashua, in Manchester. Where else do we? I think we did one. Yeah, we did one in Claremont too, I believe.
And I'll say, in their defense, they reach out to us regularly every single time this job fair happens here, and we post those and we help connect folks, et cetera. And I know that they reach out to a broad network of folks to participate.
I think last Friday was a success. So about 600 people.
Yeah.
It was like two buildings.
It's a lot of people.
Yeah. Yep.
I mean, we actually, the platform went down because we had they needed to do some work on the platform because, we had a couple there that we had issues with, and now we're back up and running, but they had the two separate buildings, but it's running well now. I mean, I like the in-person job fairs too when we're able to get back to those, and we've had tremendous success with those as well, when we've had them, but the community college, I believe, they partake in the virtual job fairs as well. But when we've had them, when we've had the job fairs at different locations, we had one at St. George Cathedral in Manchester, and plus the community colleges, they've always been there. Anything else anybody want to bring up? If not, I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
Motion to adjourn.
Move. Second.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Thanks, everybody, for coming.
Thank you.
What's that?
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, no problem. Is that all right?
Perfect.